I think that just as we're living in a nuclear age, we have grown so tremendously in scientific knowledge, it doesn't seem too much to say that men can begin to awaken to the fact that they haven't grown enough spiritually and haven't recognized their spiritual capacities.
Once something like eating is death, then you've struck at the very heart of life. The enemy of the older radical theories may have been the ruling class. But today the stakes of whether we will reform ourselves into a new kind of human being, a new kind of society, whether we will find selves worth being, the stakes of it are simply life itself.
Okay, if you haven't signed up for our free newsletter yet, why not? Just use the link in the notes below, or go to pmorin.org, which is also linked, and sign up for our free newsletter so that you know what the Morin Academy is doing all the time. And consider supporting us on Patreon, where you can get everything we do, pick and choose from our courses, choose recordings and or live sessions, etc. Do it now. Now, the reason I'm talking about this is because this is so important for our time. We have the hardest time even understanding what friendship is, let alone how to really develop one, to develop a deep, lasting friendship. To develop a deep, lasting friendship is one of the most difficult things for us to do. It's harder than ever because we are faced with the ideology of our times, and at least in the United States and in the Western world, that's very individualistic. It's very centered on self-interest. It is tending towards isolation, atomization. And technology makes it worse. It allows us to sort of like, when we're not working, envelop ourselves in a bubble of entertainment, or in some cases, anxiety-producing news or social media content, gaming, whatever it might be, that can get in the way of our ability to actually develop friendships, because friendships take a lot of time and a fairly intense interest in other people. All right, so let's get into what Aristotle has to say about the virtues first. Indeed, Aristotle in the Nicomachean Ethics defines what virtue is and then goes through a series of virtues. And I think you guys will find these virtues interesting. But first of all, he says very wisely, I love Aristotle, the way he sometimes is very blunt. He says, virtues are not the same thing as feelings. Okay, we have feelings of all kinds. They come and go. And for that very reason, we can't like say that those are virtues. They're something else. So how we feel about ourselves or our accomplishments or other people on any given day, that's not the same thing as a virtue. Nor are virtues capacities, he says, because this is, the capacity describes what we are capable of doing. And we may have the capacity for virtue, but it's not the same thing as having virtue. So then he finally settles on virtues as states of being, okay? And states, the idea of states, it implies over a long period of time, not just in any given moment, but measured by a course of a long period of time. So, for instance, he says, it should be said then that every virtue causes its possessors to be in a good state and to perform their functions well. The virtue of eyes makes the eyes and their functioning excellent because it makes us see well. And similarly, the virtue of a horse makes the horse excellent and therefore good at galloping, at carrying its rider, and at standing steady in the face of the enemy. If this is true in every case, then the virtue of a human being will likewise be the state that makes a human being good and makes him perform his functions well. All right, so there you see some of Aristotle's ideas coming together here. He's saying that it is a state of being, And it is a state of being for a human being, okay? And just as the virtue of other things leads to their full functioning or flourishing, so the virtue of a human being will lead to his full flourishing or functioning. If a person has the virtues, then they will be flourishing as a human being, okay? And we already know that for human beings, are separated from other animals by their reason, okay? Their speech and their reason. They have a particular social nature in which they use those to cooperate with each other. And we know from the politics that ideally this means being citizens together, ruling and being ruled in turn, and developing the best possible community. So it's a state of being that leads to our full flourishing as social creatures. Okay. All right. So he goes into, you know, what is the difference between a virtue and a vice? We already have discussed that virtue is the mean between two extremes. Let's deal a little bit more with this now. Okay. He says that virtue lies in the mean as defined by an intelligent person, which is an interesting way to say it. It may sound a little circular or a little self-serving. On the other hand, if you think about it, there's not a whole lot better way to define it. Okay, so he gives some examples here and he further explains it. And this is near 1106b20. He says, by virtue, I mean virtue of character. That is the state, you know, like our character is not who we are or how we feel on any particular day or particular moment, but over the course of time. So by virtue, I mean virtue of character. For this pursues the mean because it is concerned with feelings and actions, and these admit of excess, deficiency, and an intermediate condition. So we are seeking for the mean in both feelings and actions. All right. So here's what you've been waiting for, most likely, okay? And it's the most interesting part of his teachings. And I'm going to try my little camera here. I'm taking a bit of a chance, but hopefully you can see this. So I just want to read some of these and comment on them, right? But here you will get a pretty good idea of what Aristotle means by virtue and the virtues. He says, first, in feelings of fear and confidence, the mean is bravery. The excessively fearless person is nameless, and in fact, many cases are nameless, maybe because there's not that many of them, while the one who is excessively confident we call rash. The one who is excessively afraid and deficient in confidence is cowardly. So the mean is bravery. In other words, a brave person feels fear. He just doesn't feel it in such excess that he runs away. In pleasures and pains, though not in all types, and in pains less than in pleasures, the mean is temperance and the excess intemperance. People deficient in pleasure are not often found, which is why they also lack even a name. Let us call them insensible. Someone who doesn't feel, and that is a problem too. He says, in giving and taking money, the mean is generosity, the excess wastefulness, and the deficiency ungenerosity. Here the vicious people have contrary excesses and defects, for the wasteful person spends to excess and is deficient in taking, whereas the ungenerous person takes to excess and is deficient in spending. Isn't that interesting? Are you starting to get a picture there of the type of person that he's aiming at? Next, he talks about magnificence, which is a term that you will never hear today, but it was pretty important back then because the great person was expected to show magnificence in his actions and in his spending and in his way of life and so on. So as to be kind of like an ornament or glory a source of glory for the people. But anyway, he says, in questions of money, there are also other conditions. He says, among another mean is magnificence, for the magnificent person differs from the generous by being concerned with large matters, while the generous person is concerned with small. So it, I think it has to do with the type of person you are. Are you a person of moderate wealth, or are you a person who's absolutely wealthy? The excess of this is ostentation and vulgarity, and the defense is, or deficiency is something like miserliness. And he says these differ from the vices related to generosity. Okay. All right. So ostentation and vulgarity would be, you know, an example might be a wealthy person who decides that his bathrooms have to look like a bordello's bathroom in Las Vegas. Okay. Gold toilet seats or something like this. And in the other extreme is a person who's very wealthy and powerful, but who still, you know, acts as though he needs to hang on to his money at all costs and is you know, arguing over dollars and cents when it comes to putting something in his home, or in even worse, you know, holding some festivities for other people. It's particularly unattractive for wealthy people, in other words, to be miserly. All right. If a person cares too much for honor, especially if they are like very powerful, capable, influential people, if they care too much for honor and they're driven by it and everyone can see it, then that is unattractive. However, if they're completely indifferent to it, then that is unattractive. Now, if you think about this, why would that be unattractive? So the Christian virtue is different from this, and basically would say, you know, a person shouldn't care about honors at all, no matter how wealthy they are, right? They should care about others only, right? Not what they themselves can garner in the way of admiration. But from Aristotle's point of view, for the person of great capability to care at least somewhat about what other people think is good for society as well as for the person. To be completely indifferent is to not be social. All right? That's the way he sees it. To be completely indifferent is to be insensible and not social. To be the other end and always desiring it and do nothing except for to gain honors is craven and beneath the person, especially a person of great capabilities, right? So somewhere in the middle is a person who recognizes the value of honor, both because it's the esteem of others that he's earned, but also because he can then use his, what we now call social capital, in order to do things in the world, okay? So anyway, the magnanimous person is generous with his own being, with his own self, and receives honors when appropriate, but is not either craven about them or completely insensible to them. Then he moves on to anger and the virtue of mildness. He says, anger also admits of an excess, deficiency, and a mean. These are all practically nameless, but since we call the intermediate person mild, let us call the mean mildness. Among the extreme people, let the excessive person be irascible, and the vice be irascibility. And let the deficient person be a sort of inirascible person, and the deficiency be inirascibility. Well, that's helpful, isn't it? All right, let me see if I can untangle this, right? So if a person is irascible, it means that they are like very easily angered and maybe constantly angry, okay? Maybe such a person is just a plain grouch all the time. So we don't want to be excessively angry or angry for small reasons, angry all the time, but neither do we want to be this person who is, again, insensible, unable to react. If something is happening which really genuinely requires anger, the appropriate use of anger to respond to an injustice, or, you know, if somebody has basically insulted you, you don't simply ignore that. You respond, but hopefully not by murdering them, but in a measured way, right? Why is this important? Because if we cannot do this, then we cannot communicate to others when they are doing something that bothers us or not, and that breaks down the social order again. Okay, so you see how these things all keep coming back around to ourselves as social creatures. If we're too angry, drive people away. If we're not angry enough, we don't give people proper information that they need to be able to get along with us, and maybe more generally, proper information about how they should act in the world. You are just enabling, again, to use our language, you're enabling the person who's, say, rude or unjust or offensive somehow to continue to be that way if you never respond. But the trick is to respond in a measured, self-controlled way with enough anger that it actually gets across the point without severing the social connection and making it impossible to move forward. Okay, so you can see how this would be a great quality for a person who desires to live a social life. Then he says in truth telling, then let us call the intermediate person truthful and the mean truthfulness. Pretense that overstates will be boastfulness. And the person who has it is boastful. So that's the, sort of like the excess. And then he says, pretense that understates will be self-deprecation, and the person who is self-deprecating. So it's interesting how he turns truthfulness back towards the truthfulness about yourself, about how you present yourself. He isn't really referencing truthfulness about facts in the world here. He's talking about how we represent ourselves. And he's saying, you know, if you overrepresent yourself, you are a boastful person, that's not admirable. And of course, it doesn't allow you to get along with others who resent that and find it irritating. If you're terribly self-deprecating and you're always pointing out your own faults and weaknesses to others, this is also irritating. And it makes you less likable by pointing out things that people don't like. Okay, this is very simple, and yet people do it all the time. And again, the Christian virtue perspective is a little different here because it emphasizes humility so much. The self-deprecating person comes off better in the Christian context than he would in the Aristotelian context, the ancient Greek context, okay? So we don't want somebody who is always, you know, telling you how they're wrong or they need to fix things about themselves. So we want somebody with appropriate measured levels of self-esteem or pride, okay, but not too much. And he talks about wittiness here too, you know, like what kind of sense of humor should a person have. I famously don't have much of a sense of humor, at least not one that can be articulated to others very well, but he says, in sources of pleasure and amusements, let us call the intermediate person witty, and the condition wit. The excess of it is buffoonery. I love that. And the person who has it is a buffoon. And the deficient person, a sort of boor, and the state boorishness. Okay. Now, I feel this because, you know, my quest when it comes to humor is to avoid boorishness, which in our social context means not laughing at jokes, not enjoying comedy, you know, and things like this, not reacting when other people are trying to like display humor. The excess of this might be somebody who is constantly telling you a joke and trying to get you to laugh, or is what we would call a clown. Okay. So being a clown or a buffoon is irritating because it makes the other people have to respond to you constantly. Okay. You are in command. Nobody likes to be constantly sort of controlled by the other coming at them with either humor or conversation to the point where they feel like they have no room to maneuver on their own. I hope this makes sense. On the other hand, the person who has no humor and can never react to another's humor or take a sort of humorous stance towards their own life or to others is not a lot of fun. And social relationships and friendships have to have this element or should have this element of enjoyment, of humor, but in moderation. Humor is not the highest virtue. Wittiness is not the highest virtue, but it is one of the virtues and it is a part of social life. And notice how these are things, each of these are things that people can work on. Now, if we aren't extremely like powerful, capable, wealthy, magnificence and magnanimity might be ones that we might not be able to practice in the way that Aristotle would have thought of them. But in a lot of cases, people have something that they have in excess, right? Like some people are incredibly intelligent, right? They may not be wealthy or powerful, but they're incredibly intelligent. And they can use that intelligence in ways that will earn them no friends, right? By talking at people, by constantly lecturing and correcting them, by overpowering people with their own intelligence and not letting other people speak, saying that, you know, there's nothing that they have to like tell them and so on and so forth. On the other hand, a highly intelligent person who doesn't use his intelligence to help other people and to teach them when appropriate, when there really is something going on that needs correcting, and to do that in a way that is friendly and accessible to people, right? If you can't do that, then you're not being generous. You're not actually, you know, giving people what you owe them, you know, since you have this excess. All right, so you can see how it could apply if we think it through a bit. It can apply to many of us. All right, so the last virtue that I want to discuss is friendliness itself. So we're getting very specifically into the zone of this series now. He says, in the other sources of pleasure, those in daily life, let us call the person who is pleasant in the right way friendly. So the person who is in the right spot is friendly. Okay. And he says, the mean state is friendliness. If someone goes to excess with no further aim, he will be ingratiating. Okay, so ingratiation is the excess. All right. And to ingratiate yourself to somebody is to be constantly trying to please them. Might involve flattery, for instance, excessive flattery. Some flattery is actually pretty much everybody likes, but people know the difference between a genuine compliment and flattery. It might be doing excessive favors for them, you know, constantly trying to fix something for them. Trying to solve a problem for people sometimes or every once in a while or fix something for them is all right, but if you're there every day, it becomes, again, oppressive, right? It becomes kind of controlling. So flattery, favors, sort of like diminishing your own like self can come in here. So you can see how some of these things start coming together, diminishing yourself in favor of their supposed superiority and letting them know about it. These are ingratiating behaviors, and they're not conducive to friendship, right? Because they're irritating. Okay. They can sort of try to control the relationship, right, too much. And when somebody excessively flatters or gives favors or diminishes, again, they are commanding a reaction out of the other, okay? And then the other person doesn't have enough room to, like, be themselves and respond or to like give forth to the other. They're too busy reacting and in a lot of cases trying to move away, frankly. Okay, so, and then he says, if he does it for his own advantage, he's a flatterer. The deficient person, he says, unpleasant in everything, will be a sort of quarrelsome and ill-tempered person. So this is a person who argues too much, who always finds some sort of fault with you, that is never happy with you, that is, you know, demanding change excessively, okay? So, for instance, we'll put this down, arguing all the time, okay? Arguing plus demanding and expanding themselves, saying that they are, you know, somehow superior in the relationship, okay? Again, these are attributes that don't leave space for the other person in the friendship, okay? So hopefully you're seeing a pattern here. The friendly person is a mean between somebody who is too ingratiating and too quarrelsome. Think about that. I mean, all of these virtues you can kind of meditate on, but a good friend then is somebody who will argue some of the time, point out problems, okay? Will, you know, not diminish themselves when they have something valuable to contribute, okay? But will not try to diminish the other person's capabilities and virtues as well. A friendly person might give a genuine compliment, okay, but not excessively, is willing to do favors and be generous, but doesn't use favors as some sort of bludgeon or tool or weapon or transactional thing to try to elicit some sort of needed response. There's a lot more to say about friendship, and we're going to do that as we keep moving through this book. He gets right to the heart of friendship, and I may dwell more on that section next time, because I think we've got the basics here of virtues and why it is that they are important for friendship and the social life.